time. Use as directed. Follow dosing schedule. Individual results may vary. Support program can improve success rate.
The views expressed on Inside Scoop do not necessarily reflect those of the station owner, management, or staff of WAGE.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington, D.C. the government does not want you to know. And 3 years and 34 hours ago, two planes hit the two towers of the World Trade Center. Now, I know you know this because everyone listening to my voice knows this. In fact, everyone listening to my voice can tell you where they were the moment they heard about the attacks on our nation. And I want to talk today, the third anniversary of September 11th, not just about where I was, where you were, although I think it's important to relive those events and to remember how much this has affected America and American history, but also the broader questions. Where did September 11th lead us? Has it led to a changed worldview among ourselves, among our leaders? And who were the terrorists that attacked us? Who funded them? Who trained them? Where are these sources? Are we going after the terrorists that attacked us? Or perhaps are we going after someone else? And how it is that I think that September 11th actually has been used by certain people to be the third great attack on American democracy. And I'm not talking about the 3,000 Americans murdered that day, but the way the act has been used, this act of terrorism, to really strike at American civil liberties, to really challenge the idea of dissent, really what makes us all Americans. And I want to start by talking about where I was, where you were, on September 11, 2001. And if you want to call in, you're always welcome to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 1-877-57-SCOOP. 3 years ago and 34 hours ago, I was in the Rayburn House office building parking garage. I was leaving my car. It was about 10 to 9. I was getting to work right on time. Work began at 9 in the morning. The Rayburn House office building is right next to the Capitol. Indeed, all the House and Senate office buildings are right next to the Capitol. And it, like the other House and Senate office buildings, has an underground tunnel that connects to the Capitol. Anyway, I'm getting out of the parking garage, and I heard a coworker call out to me, Mark, did you hear on the radio? A plane has hit the World Trade Center. I said, really? No, I hadn't heard. Didn't have my radio on. Guess I should have. And he said, quick, let's go upstairs. Let's watch on TV. Let's find out what happened. So we run upstairs. We turn the TV on, and we look, and we see the first tower of the World Trade Center burning. And then comes maybe one of the most shocking sights I've ever seen live. We see the second plane hit the second World Trade Tower. And I knew, my friend knew, everyone knew at that point that we were under a terrorist attack. And I remember just watching the attack, thinking about what it meant, thinking that we must be at war now, with a mixture of shock and anger, as I saw people and reports of people actually dropping from the higher floors, plunging to their deaths. It was shocking stuff. It was scary stuff. And I'm sitting there in the House office building, and of course we hear that a little bit later that the Pentagon has been attacked. Now the Pentagon, that's on my way to the office. That's right en route between my home and my office. That's bringing it even closer to home. And, of course, we thought that, are we next? We're right next to the Capitol. A lot of things happened very quickly after that. We saw the first Trade Center crash to the ground. And my colleague says to me, I'm getting out of here. In fact, he left, I think, right after the Pentagon was attacked. And then after the World Trade Center falls to the ground, short succession, we get a knock on the door. The Republicans have deserted the building. The Republicans have deserted the building. Apparently, one of the Democratic staffers next door had noted that all the Republican offices were empty. No one had told us because I was working for a Democrat. And so we decided we were going to leave as well. After all, we might well be the target of attack. Certainly the Capitol was likely to be a target of attack. And we were connected to the Capitol. I, of course, had worked several times in the Capitol and as part of my job as legislative counsel for Democratic congressmen and for the House Judiciary Committee. And so, you know, we decided it was time to go, and I remember I grabbed my friend. I called my family and told them quickly about the attacks so that they knew about them and they knew that I was leaving. I woke them up. You know, I have to think that people on the West Coast have a very different perception of September 11th than those of us on the East Coast. If you're on the West Coast, probably in all probability, you were either woken up out of sleep at 6-something or 7-something, turned on the TV, saw it for the first time. I think it's very different when you actually see live the Trade Center hit. But I do remember getting in my car and trying to leave, trying to go back across the river to my home in Virginia, and all the bridges were blocked. There was really no way out. They didn't know what to do, and they blocked the bridges. And so I was in a tunnel underneath, waiting on the way to get to a bridge in a perfect traffic gridlock, listening to my radio, finding out what I suspected, that the second Trade Center had fallen to the ground, and feeling relatively safe. Relatively safe. I mean, I was in Washington, and certainly that was under attack. But mostly, I wasn't really worried about my safety. I was angry. I was sad. I was upset. I was shocked. I imagine you were too. And I was thinking, this means war. I think I said that all day that day. This means war. I was ready to fight a war. I was ready to do it the right way. You know, I'm a firm believer in our Constitution. I came to Washington really because I'd seen two dramatic threats to American democracy, which I'll talk about a little bit later. Of course, the impeachment of Bill Clinton and the 2000 coup d'etat by the Supreme Court. And I'd seen these lawless actions, these things that really violate the United States Constitution, particularly the Supreme Court saying that they weren't going to count our votes and just declare Bush the president. And this had led me to come to Washington to try to make a difference. And, you know, as cliche as that sounds, I did give up a lucrative job as a trial lawyer in Los Angeles, California, to come here to try to make a difference, to try to protect American democracy. Which I'm saying to myself, as I'm sitting under that bridge listening to the reports, I want a declaration of war. I want a formal congressional declaration of war, the way we did it in World War II. I know, as someone who studied the Constitution, that only Congress should have the right to declare war. And let's have a formal declaration. Let's get the people who did this. Let's invade. Let's go after them. And for someone like me, who had every reason to doubt the President of the United States, had every reason to doubt that he would be a strong leader, and we can talk about why I came to Washington and so forth a little bit later on in the hour, but I certainly was not very trusting of this President of the United States. But that wasn't what I was thinking at that point. I really wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking, you know, I want to hear from the president. Where is he? I want to hear him speak out. I want to hear him say that we're going to go out and get these terrorists. And I was shocked, really, that hour after hour after hour went by, and we didn't hear from the president of the United States. And as I sat on the bridge and I thought about the fact that I wanted to see a congressional declaration of war, and everyone I could tell was feeling the same. I remember as I got home and I went to the grocery store and everyone was just sort of sullen, and we were all prepared, as I guess America was after Pearl Harbor. We all knew that we were going to be in a war, and we were all prepared to fight to defend the United States of America. And that was my initial reaction on September 11th. I do want to hear yours. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, and I also want to hear how you feel that September 11th has been used and how it should be used in American history. And, of course, I welcome your calls, 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine.
Hang up and then dial your operator.
The caller has hung up. Well, I'll keep going then with my recollections. I do remember waiting for the president and thinking to myself, you know, Bill Clinton, he wouldn't have done this. He would be right there on the TV, wherever he was. He would get out there immediately and say, you know, to Americans, reassure us that we're going out to fight the enemy. And I remember thinking, you know, I'm really sorry that Clinton's not president, that Gore's not president. Where is our president? You know, totally apart from the truly weird way in which George Bush became president of the United States after losing the popular vote in the United States and the popular vote in Florida, but getting the electoral vote anyway, I was ready. I was ready for the president to come and say something. And I didn't know where he was. I don't think any of us knew that he was basically flying around. He gave a short statement in Louisiana, and then he went off again. We still didn't know where he was. Later on, we found out that he was sort of hiding in Nebraska. I remember my friend and I were joking that maybe he was hiding underneath a table in Air Force One. You see, the excuse that was given at the time, and I think people forget this, but I remember September 11th very clearly, and I'm sure most of you do too. It is a day that will be forever ingrained in all of our minds. I remember that they told us a lie that day, or at least a very, very strange statement. The claim was that the terrorists were going after the President of the United States. The idea was that they were going to take one of these hijacked commercial airliners, I guess, and find Air Force One. I don't know. I don't think Osama had satellite tracking devices, but they were going to find Air Force One and ram this commercial plane into Air Force One to kill the president. You know, I don't know if that's sort of a... People have these grandiose ideas when they're president of the United States. Everyone, they get paranoid. Everyone's out to kill them. But the idea that Al-Qaeda was going to take a commercial airliner and try to crash in midair into Air Force One, an airline with a lot better maneuverability than your ordinary commercial airliner, seems to me even more far-fetched now than it did on September 11th. Now, I can see fears that they would attack the White House. And frankly, I don't blame Bush for not flying directly back to the White House. But the idea that he was so scared that he would not even show up on TV from the airliner and report to the American people still strikes me this day as a real act of cowardice. You know, a lot of things have been done on airplanes. Lyndon Johnson was sworn in by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He was sworn in to be President of the United States on an airliner as he was coming back from Dallas, where Kennedy was shot. Despite the huge tragedy of Kennedy being shot, he understood that as a way to really make Americans feel better, feel safer, he had to show continuation of government. And while on that airline, Lyndon Johnson was sworn in. Now, Bush clearly could have done the same. Technology was even better now. He could have appeared on TV, but he was hiding. He was afraid that somehow if he gave up a satellite signal, Al-Qaeda would track him down. And I still to this day, I just don't think a real leader would have done that. Also, I don't think a real leader, of course, would have sat in a Florida classroom and when told that America was under attack, would have continued to sit there reading My Pet Goat to little children because his advisors hadn't told him what to do next. And I think in the post-war, where all these, you know, we see September 11th, mentioned time after time after time again the Republican National Convention and choosing it to be, you know, Bush's wonderful thing where he led the country and all this stuff, giving him all this credit. I think we have to remember what actually happened on September 11th. What actually happened on that day? Because, as well as Michael Kinsley has written, against the backdrop of great events, even a mediocrity can seem great for a while. And what happened on September 11th? Finally, the president came back. Finally, he spoke to us. I did think, after sitting hour and hour, I mean, I waited all day watching TV, waiting for my president to speak, and finally speaking to us, after most members of Congress had already gone back, stood on the Capitol steps, which, after all, we now know was a likely target of the fourth plane, you know, singing God Bless America, Republicans and Democrats unified together, and finally the president came and spoke. And then I thought he was slow in going to New York. I mean, again, if you think back to the days, I remember Bill Clinton went to the site the day after September 11th, stood on the ruins, comforted people the way I think a leader should. And then a couple days later, Bush finally made it out to New York and did deliver quite a stirring speech. But again, it bothered me that Bush wasn't even using the word war. He wasn't initially. He didn't seem to want to define it as an all-important terrorist attack. He didn't seem to understand, at least at the outset, that this was an attack that would forever change American history. And I understood that. I think you understood that. I think most of America understood that. And so when I think back to the date of September 11, 2001, I just remember thinking, I wish we had a stronger leader. But, again, I think most Democrats, was willing to put that aside, despite my real concerns about this president, particularly how he was chosen, my real concerns about American democracy. I was ready to see this president go forward and lead us in war, lead us to attack, and I was ready for a congressional declaration of war. And I want to talk with you tonight. Willie, where were you on September 11th? What do you remember? You know, are your reflections different from mine? If they are, that's fine. Maybe you remember Bush as a hero. Maybe you were more sad than angry. How did you respond to September 11th? The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. And when we come back, I want to talk about what the meaning is of September 11th, how September 11th has been used, if you will, as a symbol, as a policy. How does September 11th affect as we go on? Is there truly an America pre-September 11th, post-September 11th? And I know I've got some callers on the line. I want you to hang on just through the commercial break. We'll be right back with your calls and more of the Inside Scoop right after these messages.
Here's a message about Anderson Windows from J.T. Hurst & Company, a division of T.W. Perry. If you're thinking about remodeling your home, keep in mind that windows play a big part, so it's important to get the right ones. Anderson not only offers finely crafted windows and patio doors in thousands of sizes and styles, they also give you natural wood interiors, low-maintenance exteriors, and long-lasting, energy-saving performance. Stop in and see the full line of Anderson Windows at J.T. Hurst & Company, a division of T.W. Perry. The pros at J.T. Hurst can locate a contractor to do the job for you or give you some helpful tips on how you can do it yourself. J.T. Hurst, where customer service comes first, a division of T.W. Perry. On Catoctin Circle in Leesburg, Anderson Windows. Long live the home.
How many different organizations list you as a member? You might be a member of a sports team, a book club, travel or CD club. But what does that membership really mean? Does membership in a book club allow you to vote on who runs the organization? Can you help shape the long-term future of your CD club? I don't think so. You can, however, shape the future of your electric company. That is, if you're a NOVEC customer. NOVEC, Northern Virginia Electric Cooperative, is owned by the consumers we serve and governed by a board of directors elected from the membership. Pretty cool, huh? But wait, there's more. NOVEC's customers share in the company's profits. Last year, we distributed more than $9.1 million in capital credits to our membership. The power to vote and a share of the profits. Membership doesn't get much better than this. NOVEC, locally based and member-owned. For a list of customer services, answers to your questions, and even employment opportunities, visit our website at www.novec.com. NOVEC. I got the power to move ya.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. This on the third anniversary plus a day of September 11th, 2001. Do you remember where you were on September 11th? And what were your first impressions? And how have those impressions changed now that it's 3 years past, now that we can rightly treat September 11th as part of history? The call-in number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. And caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. What's your first name? Where are you from? Caller, you there?
This is Dave. Is it me you're talking to?
It is you, Dave, I am talking to.
I am Dave, and I'm listening to you on the Internet.
Okay.
On the occasion of 9/11, I was up in White City, Oregon, going into a medical appointment. But I am left with an awful lot of unanswered questions about that day. I don't think it ever should have happened. I understand it's now the opinion of most of the people of the world that it was known that it was going to happen, could have been prevented, but wasn't. It sounds outrageous, but that's...
Well, actually, I don't think that's outrageous at all. I mean, I think we know the memos that went to Bush, the ones that said bin Laden determined to attack inside the United States. We know that we had the highest amount of chatter that's what they call it, chatter. These are, of course, are things that are going through on satellites, and all the information we had from all our spy satellites and so forth. It was the highest in American history that summer, and they very much expected something to happen. You know, John Ashcroft stopped taking commercial flights. We had things in Arabic in translation that said it was going to happen specifically on September 11th that apparently were never translated. And, of course, Bush went on vacation that August, and despite Richard Clark basically banging against the wall saying we've got to discuss this, ignored him and said that, in fact, they had their first meeting on it September 4th,
yeah,
about a week before.
Millions of dollars in stock options were traded against United and American Airlines, like somebody knew that they were about to get seriously hurt. And
you know, that's a good point that isn't often discussed. That you're absolutely right about that. They were traded, and but we know, for example, that Saudi Arabian members of the royal family knew about September 11th. That in fact, there's a terrorist by the name of Zubaida in Al Qaeda that we captured. Who, and I've told this story on air before, but it bears repeating, we tried to get information out of him. He refused to talk. And then the Americans played a very intelligent trick on him. They dressed up as Saudi royal family, and they threatened him with, as a Saudi citizen, with death if he wouldn't talk. And he laughed, and he said, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. The Saudi royal family knew all about this. And they said, what? These Americans dressed as Saudis. And he explained that Prince Ahmed knew all about September 11th. He may not have known the exact date, but he certainly knew about the plot. And here's his home number, and all you have to do is contact him. And interestingly, Prince Ahmed was one of the Saudis in the United States on September 11th betting on horses in Lexington, Kentucky, who we let go due to George Bush's special relationship with the Saudis. They were allowed to fly out.
That was amazing. That was amazing to me, too, when everything else was grounded. But, you know, there's a book, The New Pearl Harbor. I don't know if you've been exposed to that.
I haven't.
It's the professor, Peter Ray Griffin, and he's amazing. He's very empiricist. He's a very rational, logical scientist laying out evidence, and that evidence becomes overwhelming. And if it's as accurate as I'm thinking it is, we have a White House full of psychopaths that allow that kind of a thing to happen for whatever motivation they might have had.
Well, but I just want to be clear, my point on the options, I don't know that anyone in the White House had those options. My guess is that there were some people in the Saudi royal family that did, but I certainly would think that it's proper to have the FBI check and find out who had those options. I mean, that's... That's a great way, it seems to me, to track it down, and one that you really don't hear much talk about. And, you know, it's a good thing that you brought it up, because it's Bush's companies. Every time he failed in his oil companies, the Saudis would come and bail him out. They have a very close relationship, and, of course, the Saudis also have an extremely close relationship with al-Qaeda. 27 pages in the classified document that Bush to this day still refuses to disclose. You know, they're looking for any little tidbit of information they can possibly find on Iraq, and the tiniest little thing that they can possibly say that maybe there was a member of al-Qaeda in a hospital in Baghdad getting treatment 10 years ago. But the Saudis, of course, are the funding engine for al-Qaeda, and 15 Saudi citizens were there, and there's very close relationships there. But of course, we didn't invade Saudi Arabia, and that's obvious because Saudi Arabia sells a lot of oil to American oil companies.
But
and
the hijackers were Arab.
Yeah, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi. The other four were Egyptian. We also supply a very large amount of aid to Egypt, more than $1 billion a year, to a dictatorship, a pretty ruthless dictatorship as it happens. And despite all of this, the most recent poll I've seen shows that 98% of Egyptians consider us a force for bad in the world. They don't like us. They and we give their country all this money. And I think, again, we support these dictators in Egypt. We support these dictators in Saudi Arabia. Don't let anybody tell you that the war in Iraq was fought over democracy, because it just doesn't make any sense. But these are people who have connections to al-Qaeda. We also know of connections in Sudan, in Pakistan, in Syria, in Lebanon. Iran has very strong connections, and in fact is largely working to make Iraq a theocracy right now. So we have all these connections, but,
Iraq seems to have very, very little connections, and yet we went to war there. And I don't know, what do you think, Dave, that people believe that there's, in their heart, the people voting for Bush, that there is some connection between September 11th and Iraq? Did you really think they believe that?
No, I think they wouldn't want to believe that. In fact, it's what you'd call ego-dystonic. They are, you know, you say that these good Christian gentlemen would have no part to play in anything like that, which makes it sound crazy that they would, but I'm convinced that we're being deceived unmercifully on this, and somebody... Who do you get to investigate it? Ashcroft? We've just seen the Congressional 9/11 Omission Commission close their eyes and stick their fingers in their ears. And
well, of course, the problem is that when you don't have divided government, when you have the, both houses of the Congress and the presidency and the Supreme Court and largely the press controlled by one party, you don't get an investigation of this kind of things. Remember, Bush opposed the 9/11 Commission before he supported it, refused to cooperate before he cooperated a little, talking with, you know, Dick Cheney and, you know, at the same time without testifying and so forth. He's very much stonewalling all this information, and I suspect that until we get a Democratic Congress, we will never know exactly what Bush knew prior to 9/11. I know this. I know the families of 9/11, most of them are very unhappy that the commission really hasn't focused on a lot of what America knew and could have done. Their report, while detailing a lot of important things, didn't focus on, for example, the war in Iraq. That wasn't their focus. And so this, all these ties that the administration is making up really just wasn't part of the report. And I suspect that we won't get a full investigation until we have a Democratic Congress, or at least one House.
You know, there's a 9/11 truth.org going on right now, and I guess professors and scientists and everybody that experts on this are coming in from all over. It's being held rather quietly. I understand that the Atlanta Journal or something has been publicizing it, but there's people there, including my professor, David Ray Griffin, that are speaking to one another of what their questions are. I think no amount of evidence is ever going to cause Republicans to think anything ever could, like this could happen. But
well, I'll tell you, in fact, I got an email on my blog, which I'm going to read, from a Republican, a frequent listener of the show, Ed in New Jersey, who indeed is still arguing for some connection. I'll read that later in the program. I want to thank you very much for your call, Dave.
Thank
I want to get
so
some other calls.
For being there, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me go to another caller and see what they have to say. Caller? You're on the line with Mark Levine. You there, caller?
Yes, I am.
What's your first name? Where are you from?
Mike, and I'm currently in West Virginia.
Okay, Mike in West Virginia. What's your comment or question? Do you remember where you were on September 11th?
I remember exactly where I was on September 11th. I was on a company run with my unit. Right after the company run, we get back to the company area. We find out the attacks had happened. I was told to go home, change, get back ASAP so that we could immediately start getting ready to deploy.
Now tell me this, what's your unit? Is it Air Force? Is it Army, Marines?
I'm prior service Army.
Okay. So you were in the Army, and they told you what? That we've got to deploy?
Well, to get ready, I was part of a rapid deployment unit.
Okay.
So anytime anything happened, we were always ramping up to go.
And how did they deploy you? I don't mean to get into any kind of security secrets. I just mean, were you used to defend a certain area of the country, or were you in planes, or what?
I was in communications, in the rapid deployment signal unit, worked in satellite. And
I see.
We were usually one of the first groups in and one of the last groups out.
So what's your comment on all of this? Do you think that September 11th could have been prevented if we'd been a little more careful in reading our intelligence?
I think a lot of stuff could be prevented if we read more into everything. You can't predict everything, though. I mean, me being in the military at the time, I would never have thought of someone flying planes into the trade centers. At the same time, I would have never thought of anyone running a boat into the USS Cole. I don't think that you can blame anybody for this as far as in our government. I mean, people make mistakes. No one is infallible.
I hear you. I'll tell you, one thing, there were some studies. Again, I'm not saying that everyone thought about it. There were studies where they pointed out the possibility of planes going into buildings that obviously someone didn't take seriously, and I wish they had. They even considered having an exercise where that would be the exercise that was canceled. Now, some bright person thought about it, and then it sort of went by the wayside. You would hope that when they're hearing all these threats, information that, you know, for example, when Bill Clinton heard about the Millennium threat, that they were going to attack us on December 31st, 2000, he hunkered down, he met with his advisors every single day, trying to find a way to prevent the threat, and either by his good you know, work or by good fortune, perhaps, we stopped terrorists coming in to bomb Los Angeles Airport. They were coming in through Washington State and through Vermont. In hindsight, I think it's fair to say that George Bush probably shouldn't have gone on vacation in August, given the very high level of threat, that he should have really spent every day working on, and that maybe then we could have hired more translators, maybe then we could have found out about it on September 10th. I can't say he would have definitely found it, but I would hope that, in hindsight, certainly, that that's something that he would have done.
All right, how much do you actually know about the military? How much have you actually been around it and experienced it?
I know a decent amount, but I'm not sure what your point is.
My point is that in the military, you go on training maneuvers.
Right.
And a lot of time these training maneuvers, like me, for instance, working in satellite, one of the scenarios would be someone jamming us on the satellite.
Sure.
All right. You know how many times that actually happens? Like never.
No, right? I understand. I understand. So, contingency plans. You got it. Right.
You can't plan and go. I mean, no one is infallible. You can't predict the future.
No, I understand
that. Yeah, someone can say, yeah, there's a possibility of planes flying into the trade centers, but there's also the possibility that birds are going to drop out of the sky and land on me, too.
Yeah, right? No, I understand that. And, Mike, I got to tell you, I'm not someone who says, as some people do, this absolutely could have been prevented. There's no question about it. It could have been stopped. I guess my critique is, well, I've got two. My pre-September 11th critique is not that we didn't prevent the specific attack, but that given the very high level of chatter, and you working in satellite know, you know, there's a time when you're getting a lot of information about an attack, more than any time in American history we'd seen prior to the summer 2001. They even called it the summer of attack in the White House. The summer of threat is what they called it. And it seems to me, pre-September 11th, that maybe we couldn't have figured out they were going to fly planes into buildings, but at least the government would have hunkered down, the president wouldn't have gone on vacation, they would have worked day in and day out to try to counter this threat that, after all, you know, Sandy Berger had specifically warned Condoleezza Rice, this is going to be the greatest threat. I just wish that they'd, you know, take a little bit more time. Whether they would have stopped the actual attack on September 11th, I don't know. But I actually have a greater critique than pre-September 11th. My greater critique is right now. Right now, it doesn't take a genius to figure out, you know, flying planes into buildings. I also don't think it takes a genius right now to think that somebody can take a big Mack truck full of explosives, much as Timothy McVeigh did, and ram it into one of our chemical and nuclear plants. Because I think we've learned from September 11th, if not from before, that terrorists don't, you know, make anthrax and make nuclear weapons and everything in their home country and bring it to the United States and attack us with their weapons. I guess they could, and we have to worry about that. But it seems to me that they use the old sort of Chinese principle of using the stronger person's force against themselves. In other words, they used our planes. They used our planes and flew them into our buildings. And I'm very concerned, and I have been since I came on the air a little more than a year ago, that they're going to take our trucks and our explosives and blow up our chemical plants, not bring chemicals from Baghdad, but right here in the United States, we have a number of chemical plants, if they're hit hard enough, can put fumes into the air and kill or at least injure thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people. And when I worked on the Homeland Security Department, I worked for the Committee of Homeland Security in my role as Legislative Counsel, we had a plan to spend, it was about $4 billion, which is about a 50th the cost of Iraq, to fortify our nuclear plants, to fortify our chemical plants. And I was really shocked to find out that the president was against this. There were a lot of Republicans that supported it, too, not just Democrats. But the president didn't want to regulate nuclear and chemical plants. He called it regulation. I called it protection. And it seems to me that now, and I want to see if you agree with me, Mike, and maybe you do, maybe you don't, that now we have no excuse in not thinking in advance and not fortifying our chemical and nuclear plants and protecting them from just this kind of attack. Do you agree with me?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. But, I mean, the only way you're going to even cut down on that stuff is by closing off our borders. I mean, I lived in Arizona. I was stationed in Arizona. There were exercises where I mean, literally saw at night, using night vision goggles, illegal aliens coming across the border.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. We have severe border problems.
You realize that it's not just the Mexicans coming over the border. They have a lingo for them. They call them OTM, other than Mexicans. All right? And this has been going on for years. I mean, this isn't something that Bush could do by himself. That Clinton could do by himself.
No, you're right. You're right. The border has always been a problem in America, and it dates back, before Bush, before Clinton. It dates back many, many years. And that's why I guess I'm arguing at first we need the temporary solution, if you will, of just protecting the places in America where people could do a lot of harm. Chemical plants, nuclear plants. But you're right about the borders.
Contracts aren't going to work. If you're going to do it right the first time. Close over the border. Stop rewarding people for coming over and shut that stuff down. You got to work from the outside in. I mean, you got to stop this from anyone coming in and doing this stuff. There are so many people here that could do it right now that, I mean, it's sad.
But see,
and then you get people complaining about the Department of Homeland Security
right.
and the Patriot Act and stuff like that. That stuff's there to protect us and to help prevent it. And then everyone criticizes it. Oh, my God, someone might actually look at my file and see what's going on.
Well,
I'll take whoop-de-doo. I don't care. I got nothing to hide.
I'll tell you how I feel about the Patriot Act, and I happen to know a lot about it because I wrote part of it. When I worked for the House Judiciary Committee, I like to think the part I wrote was a good part. My part, in fact, was a protection of people's civil liberties, saying if they're being abused, you can sue the government. I think that both liberals and conservatives have misstated the Patriot Act. I think liberals have tended to suggest that the entire thing is awful, and I think conservatives have tended to suggest that the entire thing is wonderful. And the answer is it's a 200-page bill that's got some very good stuff, breaking down the walls, allowing FBI, CIA to share intelligence, good things that I think every American should support, and some things that I don't think are necessary. And maybe you disagree with me, Mike, but I don't think the government should be reading your emails and looking at your library books and, you know, finding out what you're writing and thinking and reading unless it has some suggestion, some possibility, some evidence that you're connected with a terrorist act. And
you know what? Honestly,
yeah.
I'm a law-abiding citizen. I have nothing to hide. If someone wants to look into my
sure
shirt,
you do.
Then what? You know what? Honestly,
wait a minute. I'm not talking about breaking the law even. I mean, look, I I'm not going to, you know, you don't have to tell me and I don't expect you to, but let's just say you like to see pornography or you, you're cheating on your girlfriend or you like to go out and gamble, maybe, and you don't want people to know about it. There are all kinds of things that are legal in this country that people would just as soon not be watched and not have a big brother looking over their shoulder.
Why do anything you're not ashamed of, that you're ashamed to do and not for others to see? I mean, I've never understood that.
Really?
I mean,
you don't understand that? You don't understand why people do things that they don't want other people to know about? I just think as sort of a...
There is nothing, I was brought up, that there's nothing that I've done in my life that I'm ashamed of. That if someone finds out and asks me about it, that I can't say, yeah, I did that. It was a mistake, whatever. Or, yeah, I do that, that's fun. I mean...
I respect that, Mike. I guess I just don't think that everyone wants to have their private lives that, you know, monitored by the government. I mean, I can give you a very specific example, and again, I guess he should have been ashamed of it, but the clearest example that comes to my mind is that of Martin Luther King, who was a true great American hero in my book, but also someone who cheated on his wife. And J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI back in the 60s, tried to find all this evidence that Martin Luther King was a communist, and couldn't find any because King wasn't a communist, and looked for anything, and finally he found that King had cheated on his wife, and he used that to try to embarrass him to try to stop the civil rights movement. And I guess my feeling is that there are certain private matters that the government really shouldn't get involved in, that we should have the right to read whatever book. If I want to read a book on Al-Qaeda...
The government isn't stopping you from reading the book. I mean,
no, but they're watching you. And
you know what? Then don't do anything that you're ashamed of doing. Martin Luther King shouldn't have cheated on his wife.
That's true.
It's that simple. Don't do anything that you're ashamed for other people to know.
But, Mike, don't you think it's a problem when you have a government that has certain political motivations and they're looking for something that certain people have done? You know, they looked all over into Clinton's past to try to find something on him. You know, they failed in Whitewater, but they did find, you know, his illicit affair. They found that out. And they're not looking in the past of other people. I mean, they're not looking, for example, George Bush is most, by most accounts, did cocaine when he was a kid. And they're not going to explore that, though, because he's the president of the United States. So when you have the government having a sort of a secret police watching us, my fear is not just that they're violating our privacy and finding out things that we might not want to be public, but that they're using it selectively. They will use it against political enemies and not use it against political allies. And it seems to me, at the very least, if you're going to have a secret police watch us all, it should watch us all equally. And I don't think that's going to be the case.
I think that's pretty much happened. I mean, Bush is getting bashed just as much as Kerry is. They're both getting pulled through the mud.
But they're not. But I. The question is whether the government is secretly watching them. And that's my concern. But, hey, listen, I appreciate your views, Mike, and I hope you'll call back in another time on the Inside Scoop.
All right, have fun.
Thanks so much. Well, that was a very interesting call, and I respect Mike's views on that. You know, the government, he doesn't fear the government watching because he's not ashamed of anything he's done. You know, I don't know. I think there's some things that Americans do. Again, I gave examples of some legal things, whether it's pornography or gambling. I guess I'd even go into do a few illegal things that I just don't think the government should be watching over us, you know. You know, if you think I'm wrong, call in. Let me know. But I think this is one of the effects of September 11th. It seemed to me that the Democrats had it right. Their proposal was that the Patriot Act should only apply to people who are accused of terrorist acts. If you think you're a terrorist, then by all means, watch, spy on people, no problem. But if someone, let's say, is using marijuana, that's not enough. That's not enough to go in and invade the privacy and to read people's emails and to find out, you know, who's cheating on who and all that kind of private stuff that I just think in a free country is better off left private. But I do think, and I think Mike's call was interesting, I do think that this loss of privacy is very much part of the legacy of September 11th. We're going to go to commercial break, and when we come back, we certainly can take more of your calls and talk more of the results of September 11th. How has it affected, how has it changed our lives? The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Education, anytime, anywhere, with edanywhere.com. Edanywhere.com can help your students. We confront issues head-on with proven programs and methodologies. If your child has poor grades, reading, writing, or math difficulties, school attendance problems, a poor self-concept, or lack of motivation, edanywhere.com can help with tutoring in specific subject areas, remedial help in reading, writing, spelling, English, math, science, and social studies, GED test preparation, and accredited high school diploma programs. edanywhere.com provides a middle and high school curriculum that is delivered 24/7 on the Internet for self-paced, independent study. At-risk students in school systems nationwide have been enrolled with a success rate in excess of 85%. Register for classes now by calling 703-4ED-0805 or by downloading from www.edanywhere.com. Education, anytime, anywhere, with edanywhere.com. Committed to leaving no student behind.
America's best-dressed sandwich can be summed up by one word, Blimpy. And a mouth-watering, overstuffed Blimpy sub is just around the corner at Blimpy's newly remodeled new location on Catoctin Circle at the Amoco Station in Leesburg. Also next to the Government Center in Leesburg and on Sterling Boulevard. Stop by soon and try some delicious new wraps, including the Southwestern with turkey, bacon, and guacamole, the barbecue wrap, chicken Caesar, zesty Italian, beef and cheddar wrap, or the ultimate BLT wrap with capicola, cheddar, and bacon. And what makes a Blimpy sub so delicious? Start with a fresh baked roll, now available in your choice of honey wheat, sesame seed, poppy seed, zesty parmesan, white, and wheat. Stack it high with fresh meats and cheeses fixed to order with lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, peppers, and all your favorites. Plus, get a free 12-ounce coffee on Mondays. Stop by the new Blimpies today on Catoctin Circle in Leesburg. And don't forget the other locations, next to the Government Center in Leesburg and on Sterling Boulevard. Blimpies also has great employment opportunities.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, talking about the third anniversary of September 11th. And that was a very interesting call from Mike in West Virginia. I disagree with him. I respect his views, and I certainly respect that he's in the military defending us. But one of the great consequences of September 11th is the attacks on our privacy, is the government watching us, reading our email, seeing what library books we check out. And frankly, I think our greatest protection against this government surveillance of what we do is the fact that luckily there are billions of emails sent and millions of books read, and I just don't think they have the wherewithal to watch us all. And so my fear, of course, is they're going to do it selectively. They're going to do it against their political opponents and so forth. But as I thought about Mike's comment over the commercial break, I really think that, and again, I respect Mike's point of view, but his view that, you know, the government can watch whatever we do because he's not ashamed of anything he's done, really, that's something that's very much against the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution says that the basically that the right of people, citizens of the United States, to be secure in their persons, papers, and effects shall not be violated without a search warrant. In other words, if you write something, if you write a letter to someone, you know, if your person, you know, not what you're doing with yourself, where you're going, all of this can be secure unless you have a search warrant, unless the government believes you've committed a crime. And if the government doesn't believe you've committed a crime, they can't watch you. That's why, by the way, our mail is secret. It's a crime to open up someone else's mail. Now, maybe it shouldn't be. Maybe if we all lived our lives like Mike in West Virginia, you know, with nothing to be ashamed of, then everyone should know everyone's business. That's just not the America that I'd like to see. But like I said, I do respect his views. A number of you have written about the connection between September 11th and Iraq, and more specifically, the lack of a connection between September 11th and Iraq. And I have to say that I, myself, after watching the war in Afghanistan, I was shocked, and I wonder if you were. I really was shocked and surprised when suddenly, in September 2002, they do what Andy Card said, you know, Bush's chief of staff, rolling out a new product. They suddenly try to turn our attention to Iraq. I remember saying to myself, Iraq? Why are we in Iraq? Well, a lot of my listeners have the same view. You know, we're not going to have a lot of time to read it all on air. I suggest you go to my website, www.radioinsidescoop.com, and read through a lot of the comments that I have. I have a comment from Ed in New Jersey. Ed disagrees with me a lot, but I welcome his listening to the Inside Scoop. And he argues there were connections between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, that they basically Saddam was there when the 9/11 plans were launched, that his agents were there. I haven't seen any evidence of that, but I've asked Ed to provide that on the website. And a number of the rest of you have written in and responded that there really was no connection. Of course, the connections were to Saudi Arabia and other countries that have a much greater connection to the Bush administration and to George Bush personally. Some other comments I have. I have a comment here from Rick saying that, speaking of bravery, Jimmy Carter, during the Three Mile Island accident, showed up and toured the power plant, even though he was told it could blow any time, so he could get a grip on what was really going on there. And I have to agree with Rick that shows an amazing amount of personal courage. Rick also responds to Mike's comment on the air. He says, no one's perfect, but there still isn't any excuse for incompetence. With the amount of info the government had, they should have known something bad was going to happen, and they should have been working on it rather than going on vacation. Doing nothing in the face of possible danger borders on criminal. It just strikes me that all the talk about Bush and the hero of September 11th, really, the people aren't remembering what happened on that day, actually on September 11th. That's why I wanted to go back and think about it. And, you know, I had come to Washington really with my doubts, and I said I'd talk about this, so I'll briefly talk about it, that the impeachment of Bill Clinton, as someone who respects the Constitution, I knew that impeachment was high crimes and misdemeanors only. I had studied the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. I knew that this should be a huge crime. And that's actually what got me, frankly, to give up my lucrative job in Los Angeles and go up to Congressman Barney Frank and hand him my resume and ask him if he ever needed a lawyer on the Hill. And then 2 years later, of course, we have the greatest attack on our democracy, certainly in the 20th century, probably in American history. And that, of course, was the Supreme Court decision saying that you can't count the votes and Bush wins. And that also led me to be very skeptical going into Washington and very much wanting to go into Washington to try to make a change. Many of you know I wrote a piece called A Layman's Guide to Bush v. Gore explaining that Supreme Court opinion. I had studied all the decisions of all the courts. I'd read all the briefs. I watched that thing very carefully. And so when the decision came down selecting Bush as president, that shocking decision, I wrote a piece explaining it, Layman's Guide to Bush v. Gore. And I do want to let you know that that piece has now been newly updated. It is online. You just go to hippocampus.com/coloring book. Again, HIPPOCAMPUS, hippocampus.com/coloring book. There's a new version of the coup d'etat coloring book. And basically, it's my layman's guide to Bush v. Gore, and it has pictures over each of them, some really terrific pictures done by Maguyama and four other celebrated women artists have designed and illustrated my layman's guide to Bush v. Gore so that you can understand exactly what's going on in the threat to our democracy. And so I just wanted to recommend that on the air, but also make the point that I had every reason not to trust the President of the United States. And yet I and every Democrat on the Hill, 201, was ready to stand with the President of the United States and go in and attack Afghanistan and get back and respond to these attacks on September 11th. And as Michael Kinsley, I think, points out really well, that George W. Bush, and I'm going to be quoting a lot from his article here. George W. Bush, what do we know about him 4 years ago when most of us voted for someone else? Never before Bush, has anyone become president of the United States less pretested by life, and never has any president been tested so dramatically so soon after taking office. He was born at the intersection of two elites, the Eastern WASP establishment, the Texas oligarchy. He gimmied his way through America's top educational institutions. And in his 40s, he was still a kid, hanging around his father's White House with not much to do. A decade later, without actually winning the most votes, he was president himself. The average gas station attendant struggled harder to get where he or she is than did George W. Bush. Then came September 11th. And in a heroic saga told by the Republicans, this is where the untested leader, right, becomes a leader. And Kinsley points out it's a swell storyline, but it won't wash. Against a backdrop of great events, even a mediocrity can seem great for a while. There was a large flurry of activity after September 11th. But what has it all amounted to? Sure, we've managed to kill a few members of al-Qaeda, and no more airliners have been flown to skyscrapers since 9/11, but that was true in the 3 years before 9/11. Are we safer from terrorism than before? The only honest answer is, who knows? Whether or not you approve of the occupation of Iraq, it's beyond dispute that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. But now the world in general, and young people in the Muslim world in particular, have turned against us. An economy with heavy borrowing, goosing the... And yet it's not even clear that Bush has pulled off that. I don't have time to read the whole article. I'll just conclude by saying that, as Kinsley says, this small man had two historic opportunities to reach for greatness, to lead this country to a better place, and he passed up both. The first is when the Supreme Court chose him as president, and the second was after September 11th. He instead used that to attack his opponents. And that, for me, is my biggest regret of what happened after September 11th. This is Mark Levine, signing off.
Governor Jeb Bush is warning Floridians not to let hurricane preparations get out of hand. He says Ivan's approach has prompted a buying frenzy at gas stations in the Tampa area.
In spite of the fact that we are working hard to increase supply, imagine you can see how people by their own action could make it more difficult for us to get through this.
Forecasters say Ivan could pass over the northwest Florida panhandle by Wednesday. More than a million people have fled their homes in Cuba, where the hurricane could make landfall Monday. Our Carl Penhall reports many in Jamaica are struggling to meet the bare essentials.
Most of the residents here have been left with nothing. The few possessions that they have are now cloaked in mud. Most of them only have the clothes that they stand up with. They say that they, so far, they haven't seen any...